olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, chocolates, cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Prairie Ensemble, which presents Haydn's The Creation and John Coriolano's Creations on Friday, May 6th at 7:30 p.m. at Wesley United Methodist Church in Urbana. Featured will be soprano Kay Welch, tenor Stephen Seek, bass baritone Chad Ballantyne, and the Bach Chorus. For more information, call 355-9077 or visit prairieensemble.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking with artist Waleed Rod. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois, talked last night about some of his work, and is here in connection with an exhibition that is now to be seen at the Krannert Art Museum that he worked to put together. It's titled Mapping Sitting on Portraiture and Photography, and it is a collection of photographs of Middle Eastern people taken by Middle Eastern photographers coming all out of something called the Arab Image Foundation, which he has been involved in, and we'll talk about what that is, and in short, an effort to try to preserve photographs taken by photographers there in the Middle East of daily life there. That's where the photographs for this exhibition come from. So we'll talk a little bit about that. Also some of his other work with a group of artists called the Atlas Foundation or the Atlas Group, and some of his work that tries to bring art to bear, at least in part, to understand, to document the history of Lebanon, particularly the Lebanese Civil War of the 1980s. Our guest, Waleed Rod, grew up in Lebanon. He's been living now for some time and working in the United States. He's professor of art at Cooper Union in New York, and we're pleased to have him here with us. And, of course, questions are welcome. People like to participate in the conversation. They could do that by calling us, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me on.
To begin, perhaps, I'd like to talk a little bit about, to have you talk about Mapping Sitting. And perhaps to talk about where those photographs come from and about the Arab Image Foundation, which you were involved in setting up.
Well, maybe I can tell you a bit about the history of the Arab Image Foundation. It was started in the late 90s, 96 precisely, by a group of photographers, artists, and just thinkers. We were interested in the availability of photographs taken by native residents of the Middle East that extended all the way from Morocco to Iraq. These photographs had not been preserved, were not available in public collections, and we decided that maybe we should try to gather them and make them available publicly. We began with a small fund from the European Commission and sent out some researchers to Palestine, to Iraq, to Iran, to Egypt. We went as far to Syria and brought about maybe 30 or 40,000 images at the time within a matter of 2 to 3 years. The collection today holds about 150,000 images. A selection of the images will be available online. We've created a large database that is indexed and searchable by keywords, and the efforts has been to just make public this collection. Mm. So in a way, Mapping Sitting grew. This is the fifth project we've been involved in with the Arab Image Foundation. And it takes a particular look at portraiture in the Middle East, and whereas the other book had been more thematic, let's say, on Lebanon, photography in Lebanon in the 1960s or photography in Cairo, things like that.
One of the things that people will see, for example, if they have an opportunity to go, and I would hope people around Champaign-Urbana would go, the Mapping Sitting will be on view at the Krannert Art Museum through June 5th, so there will be an opportunity for people to go. One of the things, for example, they will see is an assemblage of photographs. They were all taken by a commercial photographer in Lebanon. They are, I think many of them were passport photos, or they were sort of ID photos that were taken kind of for an official purpose. They're all black and white. They're all the same size. And you have put together 3,600 of them, and they fill one large wall and a couple of side walls. So when you first go in and you see it, the thing that just strikes you is how many images. You almost can't really concentrate on any one because there are so many. And then it gives you the opportunity to actually spend there as much time as you possibly can or want to, looking at each person. And there are men and there are women and there were children. Tell me about that piece and what interested you in taking a large number of these photographs that were all taken by the same photographer, they're all in the same place, and grouping them that way.
Well, the photographs come from a studio of a photographer named Antranik Anoushian, who worked in Tripoli in northern Lebanon from 1929 to 1991. So his studio kind of spans, in a way, the history of Lebanon from before the establishment of the state to the establishment, the advent of the nation state into the Civil War and after. And this was one of the few collections we still had intact, where he had kept the negatives from 91, from 29 all the way to 91. So we're very interested in the amount of images we were able to secure. And we were able to secure negatives in the form of gelatin negatives as well as plates, glass plates. Viewing the images, we're just fascinated by the number of people who would come. I mean, of course, having put this up now, and we do put them up one picture at a time. So we've put them up, I think, 14 times. We've become very familiar with some of the faces in this room. Mm-hmm. And we've become very familiar with the individuals who would come back, whether it was years late. One time they might come in the 50s. They might come back again in the 60s. Sometimes they would come in the same week with different clothes because they didn't like the photographs that had been made of them. So we became very interested in how, when we started arranging them, the poses that the photographer asked the sitters to take in the 20s differed a little bit from the poses he was asking of them to take in the 30s. And of course, when the nation state came into being, the photographs had a very different function. They were starting to function in identity cards and passport photos. They were passports. They were starting to function in as the marker of national identity. And hence, it had to be regulated by some kind of system. Namely, did you have to show your left ear? Did you have to be against a white background, a dark background? Did the shoulders have to be square? And we became very interested in how the photograph kind of became an object for the state to regulate the making of citizenship through photography. By arranging them the way we did, they started to look to us like a group portrait, essentially. They started to look like the making of a nation, all these individuals sitting next to each other with the ideals of the nation, the coming nation state, namely their equality under the law. Their equality was manifest here visually in front of us in photography, and photography was producing that equality, was participating in producing the ideals of this democratic state.
Yeah. You mentioned that you have now put this up a number of times. I believe that here in the United States at the Granite Art Museum, this is only the second time that this exhibition has been seen here. It was in New York and now it's here, and only these two places here in the United States so far?
So far, we know that it's going to Reed College after this, and we have been in discussions with two other institutions after this. So the exhibition might circulate for the next maybe 18 months to 2 years.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that one of the key reasons for wanting to preserve and display these images is that for so many people in Europe and in the United States, the images that we see, the photographs we see from the Middle East, particularly in the last few decades, are photographs of conflict. And mostly I would expect that they're taken by Westerners. They're taken by photojournalists from the United States, from Europe. I'm sure that there are Middle Eastern photojournalists who do take pictures, but a lot of them are not. And I get this sense that part of what the Arab Image Foundation is about and something like Mapping Sitting is an alternative view, offering something different from those kinds of images that we see much more routinely of Middle Eastern life.
There's no doubt about this, or this is certainly a dimension that we're responsible for, but maybe I can give you a sense of how we do our research, because mm-hmm. it will help clarify this dimension. The way we proceed is we don't tend to be exhaustive right now. In other words, we don't go out and say the West has misrepresented the region, and in fact, there's a tradition of local photography that is radically different from the available images. We should gather them and make them available. Or we don't proceed from the assumption that we need to mimic the Western canon of photography history. In other words, we're going to produce our own modernists, we're going to produce our own grand figures, the grand masters of photographers. We didn't proceed with this project with the idea that we need to repeat a series of movements and produce master photographers. In a way, the way we work is we take our members, we ask our members, what are you interested in, 7 or 8 photographers, and they go out and bring back photographs according to their interests. So it's less to produce a comprehensive history than what are they interested in. So in a way, one of the things that was a bit surprising maybe with this exhibition when it came to the United States, it was less so in Europe, was this idea that Arabs are just like us. And that there's constantly this surprise at the fact that the images available are proof of this similarity between the natives of this region and elsewhere. This was somewhere in our mind, but it was clearly not the dominant kind of motif in beginning this research. What we want to ask all the time is, what do we come to know about the Middle East, about photography, through these photographs? Here, our emphasis was on examining photography's relationship to the advent of the nation state, but we're clear that we're exhibiting these images in a place that has been deluged with particular images of the region from Iraq, from Lebanon, from Sudan, from Egypt, images that certainly do not offer an image of complex life in the Middle East, and that when we bring other kinds of images and taking in consideration the non-availability of alternative images of the region, I guess we should have expected that this reaction would come up, namely, wow, they do the same things we do. They walk down the streets.
They go swimming.
They try to have a life. And this has taken us a bit by surprise. In Europe, I don't think it was so much so because, of course, they have a history of travel they have their colonial history in the Middle East and much more maybe cultural exchanges, people exchange. Hmm.
Let me just introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Waleed Rudd, and also mention that the exhibition that we're talking about, which is called Mapping Sitting on Portraiture and Photography, is now on display at the Krannert Art Museum on the U of I campus and will be on view through June 5th. So if you'd like to stop by there, see various things that the museum has to offer, including a nice little area where they're showing some photographs from the Krannert Art Museum collection. Very, very nice pictures to see, too. And all the other things they have at the museum. So stop by and take some time and walk around through the museum. Waleed Rudd, as I mentioned at the beginning, grew up in Lebanon and has been living now for some time and working in the U.S. He's professor of art at Cooper Union in New York. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Do you think of yourself primarily as a photographer?
I was trained in photography. Mm-hmm. In fact, my interest in photography grew out of my father had a 2.25 camera that he used quite extensively. And I, of course, became very fascinated with the technology of photography. My interest peaked maybe at the beginning of the civil wars in Lebanon in 1975, when the country was kind of witnessed the arrival of all these photojournalists who came to the city to kind of report on the latest cycle of violence. And I remember being fascinated by these figures who would come, put themselves on the line. They came with their equipment. They did things that I wouldn't dare to do. They went to the front lines. They got close to what they saw as the site of violence. And then they, of course, went back. I became very interested in first the lifestyle, also the technology, but soon got disabused maybe of this fantasy of the photojournalist when I failed to see my experiences in some of these images. I failed to see kind of the kind of identification of violence with bodies, with dead bodies, with scarred buildings, the identification of the war only with those kinds of images became a bit reductive for me. It did not account for the complexity of life in Beirut as I was growing up. In the early 1980s, as a result of various conflicts, local militias were recruiting young men in various neighborhoods to go and fight for them. We were middle class. We had adjusted about enough money, and my father just gave me, I remember at the time, $500 and said, find your way out of here and just go. And I ended up in the United States in 1983. You don't send middle-class Lebanese kids to the United States to do visual arts. You send them usually to do business or law or medicine. I did medicine for pre-med for about a year and a half, and then just was doing photography all along and enrolled in a photography program for 4 years. So in a way, I was trained in photography. I was trained in the technique in photography, the history of photography, and the kind of formal language of photography. And that stayed with me today.
Hmm. Tell me about the Atlas Group.
Well, the Atlas Group is a separate project from the Arab Image Foundation. The Arab Image Foundation is a collective of individuals. The Atlas Group began initially as an individual effort. It's the name of a project and of a foundation that concerns itself with the history of Lebanon, primarily the history of the wars of the past 30 years. The way we work, and I say we, although many of the documents presented are documents that I have found or produced, the way we work is we tend to find or produce documents that shed light on this history. And we've organized all of the documents that we have found and produced in the Atlas Group archive, located in Beirut and New York City. And we make public our works through exhibitions, lectures, publications, or screenings. Most of the documents in the archive are documents that I produced, but that at times I attribute to imaginary individuals or institutions, such as a historian, Dr. Fadl Fakhouri, that I present as having donated to the Atlas Group a number of notebooks, films, and photographs, and that are indexed under the Type A file category in the Atlas Group. Another such imaginary character is Suhail Bashar, who is presented as a hostage who had spent some months in 1985 in the same room with five Americans who were kidnapped in Beirut in the 1980s. Other documents are attributed to the Atlas Group itself. In other words, not all of the documents we have are attributed to imaginary figures. Now, all of the documents are a mix of historical artifacts and the imaginary universe in which these historical artifacts can exist. And maybe we can discuss this a bit.
Well, this I think is one of the very interesting things about the work and about what you do. It lies at the intersection of art and history and journalism, opinion, commentary, and all of these things are drawn in. You use art, graphic representations, photographs, moving images, as a way of telling the story. But there definitely is a story that's, you know, at first blush seems almost to be a work of journalism. And it certainly is because, as you have explained, it's an effort to document the facts of what happened in Lebanon during the time of the Civil War. And, for example, maybe some people had the opportunity to hear you last night and see the presentation that you gave looking at a car bomb and something of what happened and some images connected with it, and that this was, as you pointed out, during that time there were more than 3,600. So you picked one and tried to tell something of the story of how that happened. So partly this is journalism and partly this is art, and I'm not even sure what all else it is.
Well, it's always an attempt to try to think the way we're always thinking is, how do we make sense of some of these images, experiences, and feelings of the past 30 years in Lebanon? And it so happens that I think maybe the visual arts, but not unlike probably literature, not unlike maybe philosophy or other areas in the humanities, it's one of the few areas where this kind of the limits have become very porous. In other words, one can bring insights from other disciplines into visual arts, and it doesn't seem to cause a crisis. There isn't an insistence that you stick to a particularly intradisciplinary kind of relationship to the material. So it's been very generative for us to think anthropologically. It's been very generative for us to think sociologically, to bring the insights of architects, urbanists, urban planners, engineers, to bring the insights of philosophers and political scientists into thinking about this history of the car bomb, into thinking about the history, what happens to cities when they live under this threat of assault, what happens when 3,600 car bombs go off in one city over 15 years, without even mentioning the history of other kinds of assault, whether it's shelling, whether it's kidnappings, whether it's random violence, shootings, and what have you. I mean, to give you a sense of, maybe we can talk a bit about the hostage, the Bashar thing. Mm-hmm. I think it might be an interesting way to think about this relationship between the real elements in the stories and the imaginary universe. As you may know, in the 1980s, a number of Americans were kidnapped in Lebanon. They were kidnapped for various reasons, but the primary reason was maybe Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982, an invasion that sought to expel the PLO, partly to expel the PLO from Beirut. This invasion was quite brutal, and in fact it ended up alienating a large portion of the population of South Lebanon, who organized and in fact felt at some point that their resistance to the Israeli occupation of Lebanon was also a resistance to American support for this Israeli occupation. And some radical elements decided that, with the support, of course, of other states such as Syria or Iran, began kidnapping Americans, French, German, British, Irish men primarily, and would hold them for a long time, men such as Terry Anderson, Martin Jenko, David Jacobson, and what have you. And this kind of scandal, of course, triggered a number of larger political scandals in the region, like the Iran-Contra affair in the United States. I'm sure everyone remembers the figure of Oliver North in 1987 testifying in front of Congress. And so it had, quite an impact on the public, political, and cultural life of the United States in the middle of the 1980s. And the Iran-Contra affair, of course, was a central event. I remember it dearly. I was just in undergraduate school, but sitting in front of the television, watching the congressional testimony and the investigations that went on and on and on until 1991, in fact, when the Lawrence Walsh published his independent counsel report. So the story is rich. It's rich at the same time in the sense that you also have men who were kidnapped in Beirut, who were beaten up, blindfolded, who were harassed, who were who suffered tremendously physically and psychologically in Beirut. The last one coming out is Terry Anderson on December 4th, 1991. And I remember it was I'm not sure if you remember this period or these events, but it was quite an emotional time.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And so 2 years later, well, throughout these years, a number of books by ex-hostages were published in the United States. David Jacobson had published his book. Benjamin Weir had published his book. Peggy Say, who was Terry Anderson's sister, had published a book titled Forgotten. And the book circulated widely. And by the time Terry Anderson was released and published his book was on the bestseller list. In the UK, it was similar with men such as John McCarthy, who had also published quite a nice volume in Tom Keenan, and an Irish Englishman who published also a very impressive volume on this history. And I decided that I should read the books. I should read the books because I had worked quite a bit on Lebanese men and women who had been kidnapped and detained. And I had worked on their numbers. And I was, first of all, well, maybe I shouldn't be surprised, but I was shocked by the attention in the Western popular press given to 7 or 8 Americans, given their complete disregard for the thousands and thousands of Lebanese and Palestinians who were in Israeli detentions and cells. And of course, it would make sense that we live in America, we're going to be concerned with the lives of Americans. But given that the fate of these men who were kidnapped was so intimately tied to the fate of these others who were kidnapped, it would at least merit mention. It would at least merit attention. It would merit some kind of historical perspective on why are Americans being kidnapped in Lebanon, as opposed to they're just being kidnapped by evildoers or people who want to do harm to the United States for no reason whatsoever. So I began reading the books. And I, of course, in terms of this multidisciplinary approach, how do you make sense of books? How do you make sense of the testimony of men who are being kidnapped? How do you account for how somebody speaks about their violence, personal violence done to them, and how they testify to it? How do you account for the political context in which this violence is being written? So I needed to study the history of Iran-Contra. I needed to study the history of the United States in Central America. I needed to study the history of the United States in Iran and Lebanon. I needed to read the public investigations. Then not only do I need to read the testimonies written by the Americans But it turned out that, for example, captivity narrative is a genre indigenous to America, right? And that, in fact, there's a literary history of captives writing this story and publishing them. And that many of these men, of course, did not write the books themselves. They hired ghostwriters who had written other captivity narratives. So in a way, the literary tropes used to describe this experience have as much to do with the experience of being a captive as it does with how the story is written to begin with. These books are made into films, they're made into theater productions, they circulate widely in culture, and they capture the attention and belief of a nation, here and elsewhere. What are the images that can do this? So in a way, we had to bring a literary perspective, a sociopolitical perspective, and clearly an understanding of what it means to speak about violence and write it. I'm going on. Nick,
no,
I hope you don't mind.
No, I'm spellbound. Go ahead.
Okay. So I'm even going to go on another tangent, if you don't mind. But this episode came to the scandal of the Iran-Contra was tied to this accusation that the United States was, in fact, selling weapons to Iran in order to secure the release of the hostages in Lebanon. And the idea was that Iran was a major sponsor of Hezbollah in Lebanon, the men who had supposedly kidnapped the Americans, and that Iran, in fact, needed weapons because it was American weapons, because it was engaged in this brutal 8-year war with Iraq. Their army had been built by the Shah of Iran with American weapons. Their planes were falling apart. Their spare parts were needed. The only people who could provide these spare parts were the Americans. But the American Congress had tied the hands of the president. In fact, Iran was designated in 1984 as a state that sponsors terror. And in fact, no sale of weapons could directly happen. You remember how this unfolded, because if the United States can't sell weapons to Iran, what do? They convince their allies to sell weapons, and then they simply replenish the stock. So they convinced first Israel to sell their weapons to Iran, which they did, and the Israelis were really smart about this. They started sending old weapons in the hope of getting new ones from the Americans with Hebrew markings on them to Tehran, which landed in Tehran. It pissed off the mullahs so much that they raised the price of every American hostage. It's almost funny. And subsequently, the Americans decided they can't go through this intermediary. They're going to do this by themselves. And this is the famous trip that Robert McFarlane takes to Tehran, a trip that was documented in a beautiful book by a woman named Anne Rowe, a journalist for The Guardian. And she tells us the story of McFarlane picking up this man called Ghorbanifar, who was an arms dealer, and that they take with them to the mullahs, and with a shipment of arms, they take with them a cake in the shape of a key to signal the opening of relations, and a kosher cake at that. They take with them two Colt pistols that Reagan is giving to the mullahs and a Bible signed by Reagan. Go figure. We're going to Tehran. We're taking a cake to signal the opening of relations, some Colt pistols, and a Bible to the mullahs, to fundamentalist Iranians in power. They land. The Revolutionary Guards that meets them is so famished they eat the cake immediately. They stay in a hotel for 3 days and then are sent home. This is the trip that becomes the trigger of the Iran-Contra scandal. This is the revelation of this trip that starts, are we dealing with these people? What are we doing? I mean, of course, there's been speculation that we've been dealing with the Iranians for longer and that Reagan had made a deal in 1980 to secure the election, but we won't go into this. But essentially, the sale of arms to Iran does lead to the release of Americans in Beirut. Now, before Hezbollah would get instructions from Iran, we've received weapons, you're going to get your cut, start releasing, they would take the Americans they have in captivity and put them in the same room. The idea being, they're about to be released, coming out of a permanent isolation is quite difficult on the body. Let's put them together, raise their morale, they'll look better when they come out. They won't look like they've been treated so badly. So in the summer of 1985, when these arms dealing was happening, 5 Americans were kept in the same cell. They were brought in. And how do we know this? Because they've all described this period in their books. So we have 5 books that describe these 3 months from 5 different perspectives. It's fascinating. Do they all tell the same story? Are there variations on the story? What kinds of variations? Do these variations matter? And at some point, they all describe an Arab man who's brought in and detained with them in the same cell. And they describe him as Wajid or Wajid, Domani or Dumani. Anderson's book defines him one way, Jacobson's book another way. So I became very interested in this man's story. Is he around? What did he think? Because he's also described as somewhat of a pain. He's constantly complaining. He's constantly whining. And in fact, he's just not a good hostage to be around. And in a way, I couldn't tell whether he was becoming the projection of their fantasies about who Arabs were. These are close quarters, so in a way, men sleep very close together. When men sleep together, their bodies touch. When their bodies touch, what is the distinction between the erotic and the homosocial, especially from men who are all clearly married, who had particular relationship to sexuality? Do they talk about these things? But the Arab all of a sudden became very suspect. His sexuality became suspect, whereas each other's sexuality was never suspect, for example. So I became interested in why this figure of this man became the object of their projections. And I wanted to find him. And I wanted to say, did he have another story to tell? I couldn't find him. I made some phone calls. Is he around? Where is he? Can we locate him? Can we bring him back? Does he have another perspective to offer? Pretty much nothing. And then I decided that, in fact, what I needed to do, this project that I should be doing, was not so much about him as much as it was about his construction by these Americans in the cell as this figure of anxiety, fear, and dread. And it became clearly about the history of the Iran-Contra affair. Because while five investigations have happened, five investigations between 1987, starting with Mises' fact-finding inquiry up to Lawrence Walsh, and I've read through these tomes of investigations, a simple question is asked but answered very briefly. The most important questions: why were Americans kidnapped in Lebanon in the 1980s? You would think this is the most important question to ask. The investigations do one thing very well. They end up kind of celebrating the good health of the American system. In other words, they may say, horrible things have happened here, illegal things have happened, but our system of government is so good that when bad things happen, we catch them. Right? So instead of asking policy questions, historical questions, you turn the affair around onto the celebration of the good health of the American system, not unlike when these demonstrations against Iraq were happening here last year in 2003, in February. The president can clearly come out and say, well, yes, we have 250,000 people marching in the streets, but that's what's good about America. And that's why they need us over there. In other words, instead of asking policy questions, you say, we have democracy and democracy is good, hence we have to export it. It's a brilliant kind of political move to do. So this lack of analysis of the historical dimension of the kidnapping of Lebanon became something that needed to be addressed, especially today when many of these men are back. Right, people like John Ashcroft, Elliot Abrams, Otto Reich, John Negroponte, people who devised and implemented U.S. foreign policy in Central America and the Middle East in the 1980s, now are again devising and shaping U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East and elsewhere in the world. Mm-hmm. So it's an important event to keep in mind. It's an important crisis to bring back, to keep alive. Yeah. Sorry about this long.
No, that's good. We're talking this morning with artist Waleed Rad. He's trained as a photographer. As I mentioned, he was born and grew up in Lebanon, and for some time now has been living and working in the United States. He is the founder of the Atlas Group, which at the beginning I think was just him, and now has also involved some other people. And part of the idea behind the Atlas Group, as he's explained, is to document, to try to explain, to try to understand the Lebanese Civil War that was fought in the 1980s. He was also involved in something called the Arab Image Foundation, which was an attempt to rescue and preserve photographs of people of the Middle East taken by indigenous photographers and Middle Eastern photographers. And some of the pictures from the Arab Image Foundation make up an exhibition that is now on display at the Krenet Art Museum on the U of I campus. It's titled Mapping Sitting, on portraiture and photography. That will be on view through June 5th. So if you have the opportunity, you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, you could stop by the Crown at Art Museum. There are a lot of things there to see. On view through May 8th, there's the School of Art and Design Master of Fine Arts exhibition. You can see that. And actually, tomorrow might be a good day to think about going over to the museum. They're having Family Festival from 10 until noon, and they'll have some live music in the galleries with the Craig Russo Latin Jazz Project. So that's yet one more reason to go over to the museum. If the kind of stuff that's there all the time isn't reason enough, you might want to go in and take in some of these special special projects. Questions, too, are welcome. 333-WILL or 9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I wonder if we could come back to the subject of mapping sitting and the fact that these are all portraits. There are the pictures we talked about at the beginning that were taken all in this one studio that were official pictures for passports or other identification. There are some other things that are group photographs. There are some other photographs that were taken by another photographer who traveled around. And apparently at one point he went to the beach and there were people there who were out swimming and sunning. And he apparently went up to people and said, you know, could I take your picture? And posed them all in a similar kind of way. So there's one section of the wall where there was a number of these photographs, and I think they're almost all men. There's at least one woman. They're almost all men. Very sort of similarly posed in a semi-candid way, I guess. So one way or another, all of the pictures are portraits, more formal, less formal. As a photographer, what is it that interests you particularly about portraiture?
Well, this man you're mentioning is actually a fascinating character. His name is Hashim al-Madani. His images today comprise half of the images in our archive. In other words, out of 150,000 images, almost 70,000 of those images come from his studio in Sidon, in southern Lebanon. Mm-hmm. He is still alive, his studio is still open, and he's the only photographer whose works we don't buy, we just support. We are his only means of support. And we, through him, we can get a good sense of what it meant to be not just an abstract commercial photographer, but a photographer who lived in a city for 50 years, who had intimate connections, relationships with the people he encountered. His studio, like most studios of photographers, were not located on the ground floor because it was thought to be not a very nice thing to go into a photographer's studio, especially if you're a woman. So they put the studios in the second floor so that you weren't visible in the to the passersby. Mm-hmm. Most of the research on this man is done by the co-curator of this exhibit, Akram Zaatari, who is in fact the research engine of the Arab Image Foundation. He's an intellectual kind of center, and clearly has traveled widely, done a lot of the work on the exhibition here at Mapping Sitting, and also on this particular figure, Hashim al-Madani. Madani had a particular trajectory. Every morning he would wake up, take his camera, walk down to the beach, where he would photograph men or women. In this particular reclining figures on a rock, in fact, there are four women. One whose name is inscribed in the sand, Lilian. Mm-hmm. Another photograph where a young woman poses, but if you look closely on the right-hand corner, you just see the outline of a woman's leg and hands, and in fact, it's her mother who was carrying a blanket. So she allowed her daughter to pose, and as soon as the photographer was done, she's going to run over and cover her again so that lest anyone else watch. Mm-hmm. And there's a very young girl who's posing on the sand. And he would photograph on the beach, then would go on the market, photograph inside the market, then go home and develop the roll of film he had developed. Then he would go to the movie theater every single day. And he would take pictures inside the movie theaters of people watching movies. So you have these flash photography indoors, inside movie studios of just people sitting, watching a screen. Come home, have dinner and print the photographs he had made. Then he would cut the photographs into small little images that he pasted on a notebook. Would take the notebook with him the next day, and he takes great pride in the fact that 90% of his photographs were sold and the other 10% he gave because he was such a kind of generous person. His trajectory, he did this for 50 years. Many of the people he saw daily. These are not people he could photograph, and the next day they would say, I don't like my picture. If they didn't like the picture, they knew the photographer was coming around the next day. Either they could let him know for sure or produce another photograph. We're constantly now bringing, we're in fact trying to preserve his studio as a genre, because it's symptomatic of a particular way of making photographs that we are finding pretty much everywhere in the Arab world. And because he's still alive, because his studio's intact, because we have his negatives, we think we should spend a lot of time kind of studying this one case and make it a case study of a particular kind of photography. A photography that, in terms of portraiture, I mean, he also did portraiture for him is fascinating, because we tend to think of portraiture of images of figures, of weighty figures in society, you know, of kings and queens and presidents and members of parliaments and respected figures. This is the guy who was doing the other end. This is the guy who was basically making photographs for the working class, the middle class, in a city that, if you look at these photographs you mentioned just now, we would show him the photographs today and he remembered almost every single person's name again. The only people he wouldn't remember were Christians and Palestinians. So he would say everyone else's name he would identify, and we would check to make sure his memory was correct. Mm-hmm. And then we would come to photograph and say, oh, that's a Christian, or I can't remember, or this is a Palestinian. And in fact, why would he not remember Christians and Palestinians? Palestinians came to his city in the late 60s and 70s, didn't stay too long, and then left. And the Christians, he was a Sunni Muslim. He didn't kind of interact much outside the Sunni Muslim community. So his relationship was a kinship relationship with others from his, what he defined as his community. So in a way, his practice spans all the way from making photos of people for election card permits. You know, something very simple as running down the street, the local person running for election, he would say, listen, we have to get these people to vote, go take their photographs so we can make them identity cards so they can vote. So he would run out, make those photographs, all the way to making photographs of the actual member of parliament himself. I mean, he takes great pride, actually, in the canonical figures he has photographed. So we like how broad, we like how formally interesting he is. He would receive these Kodak manuals that told him, if you put a figure against the sun or on a reclining beach, you would get this kind of nice little gesture and photograph. So he would go out and try this out, and you end up with people who look very odd posing on a very uncomfortable rock.
Yeah.
So this is why we're interested in him. And in a way, it's to think, where do these forms come from? Like, how do you, for example, we tend to think, oh yes, it makes sense to take a picture of a person to include head to toe. Well, in what way is this evident? It's common sense that a picture might include somebody head to toe. It's not surprising if you see a photograph like this. Another photograph would tell us, a photographer would tell us, well, these French soldiers in the 30s and 40s would come and insist on being photographed head to toe. And we think, okay, well, why would they do that? They would say, we have to show the feet. Our parents have to know that our feet are still here. Right? In other words, they were simply afraid that they had gotten wounded and one of their limbs had gotten cut off. So photographing head to toe was important for a different reason than because of a kind of a formal convention inherited from the practice of portraiture or in painting or what have you. It's important because of war. It's important because of French soldiers in the Middle East needing to communicate with their families. It's important because of medicine. So we like how, in a way, the history of photography, the history of art, is kind of being... there's all these tangents that constantly interrupt it and remind you to read this history differently. Hmm. And we're finding it in these practices.
Hmm. We're coming down to the point here. We have maybe about 7-8 minutes left with our guest, Waleed Rad. I'm interested in maybe having you talk a little bit about the way now you and maybe other people think about photography in this sense. I think for a long time, the thing that in people's minds distinguished photography from other art forms was that we had this idea that a photograph was true. That the idea was that we go out there with the camera and hold it in front of whatever was taking the picture, and we press the button and we get a true representation of that thing. Now, with the advent of digital photography, it becomes much easier to manipulate images. It could always be done, but it's easier now to do that. And now we have reason to question the truth of the photograph in a way that perhaps we did not before.
That's accurate in the sense that, as you, I think, mentioned, what's fascinating for me about photography, here's a technology where light bounces off of objects, enters a lens, produces an image that used to be in the 1840s, in 1849, grainy, black and white, upside down, and flat. In what way could this flat, upside down, grainy image become consistent with reality is a fascinating argument, right? Because the mediation that you're discussing, this fact that it's non-equivalence with reality, it doesn't look like the real, it's not three-dimensional, it doesn't move, it's not in color. In what way something so mediated, even its inception, in its birth, could become within a few decades synonymous with reality? That's what's fascinating to me about it. Not so much whether I think the ideas that photography was, one can manipulate the photograph, has happened since the birth of photography. In fact, the advent of digital technology was simply another chapter in this kind of unfolding story. Mm-hmm. But what is fascinating, how could something so mediated become equated with the immediate? Something so heavy with forms and the language of the technology, the apparatus. I mean, the photography was thought to be the pencil of nature. Photography was thought to be more real because there was no human intervention. It was simply a machine recording the real. There was nothing human about it, which meant that the person who invented the camera was kind of marginalized as from the question of what counts as humanity. When the camera becomes itself the equivalent of a machine that is not invented by humans, that's quite fascinating. How could you think of a camera as something that is not human, as something that is not invented by humans, according to human conventions, according to technology developed in a particular place and time? So that's a fascinating dimension to me. Here, what we have, I think, with the advent of digital technologies, is maybe this transformation from the analog to the digital. And that, by that I mean, today, photography has become, in the language of digital technology, consisted of pixels. And what is a pixel? It's a picture element. It's not a unit of measure. It's just a term for a picture element. So essentially, the photograph has become millions of picture elements, just as it might have been grains. And it is those that have become so kind of transportable, so interchangeable, that in effect it permits this manipulation you're describing. So the real has been segmented into a million of little fragments, all equivalent, not unlike this passport photo we have. Essentially, this passport photo of 3,400 images, mm-hmm. is a set of little pixels, all mm-hmm. equivalent and all interchangeable. So this kind of language of the commodity, the language of photography, the language of the nation state, is also the language of pixels in digital photography.
I want to try real quick to accommodate a caller here. We have somebody here on the cell phone on our line number one, so let us do that. Hello.
Hi, I just make a very quick comment. You're talking about taking pictures of a person's full body because it would show whether a person was intact in a place where there was war. Reminded me of a guest who was on who had distributed a whole bunch of throwaway cameras to people in a village, and when he got all the photographs back, it might have been a woman, I think, when she got all the photographs back, she found out that nobody's feet were being photographed, and she couldn't understand it, and she went back to the village, and it turned out that people's feet weren't photographed because basically whether you had shoes or not was a sign of your social status, and it was considered impolite, therefore, to take a picture of someone which would reveal which part of the social strata they were in. And so, you know, in contrast to Susan Sontag, I think what we're seeing is that photography, which is inherently a visual thing, which is the way the human mind works visually, is becoming a great tool for understanding culture and understanding the world. And I just wanted to say that. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. You want to comment on that?
Well, it sounds it sounds very rich. Thank you.
I guess I'm still thinking about that, and here I can't really even give you enough time probably to talk about it very much. But I'm thinking about that point you were making about when you look at the early days of photography and you look at the result, there's a lot of important differences between what you see when you look at the photograph and what you see with your eye. And yet very quickly we do get to this point where people do come to regard the photograph as real, something maybe in a sense almost more real than what we see with our eye.
I mean, there's this famous photograph of Nicéphore Niépce of a boulevard in Paris, one of the early photographs. And you look down Lotus Boulevard, and there's nobody except one man getting his shoe shined. Because, of course, these early exposures required minutes to happen. So anything that did not stand still for minutes ended up being disappearing. Does that mean that, in fact, Paris was empty? This was a bustling city with crowds and coaches and passersby. And here we have one man. Who, I mean, I would like to take this literally. I would like to think essentially that all these people did not show up, that maybe because they were vampires. Maybe they failed to appear in cameras. But it would have to be a much more elaborate discussion.
Yeah. Well, there was so much more that we could talk about. I really have enjoyed having you here to speak. I do want to say again that folks here in and around Champaign-Urbana certainly can go and see the exhibition that we have talked about, Mapping Sitting on Portraiture and Photography, that will be on display at the Crandon Art Museum through June 5th. And if you're interested in a little bit more about our guest and about the Atlas Group, they do have a website, and it is an easy address to work with. It's www.theatlasgroup.org, and you can see some of the work that he has done, some of the material that he's talked about, so you can kind of get a sense of what it is all about and what he's trying to do. And I certainly would suggest people to go down to see Mapping Sitting. Take the opportunity to see only the second time here in the United States that this has been available. And also, is it possible to view images from the Arab Image Foundation online?
Yes, the website is www.fai.org.lb. That's fai.org.lb.
LB for Lebanon.
That's right.
Okay. Very good. Our guest, artist Waleed Rahd, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. Well, our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. The broadcast is also made possible with support from Owen's Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign. Locally owned and operated, serving families since 1925, Owen's Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. Coming up a little later today, as part of the Afternoon Magazine, it's almost 35 years since National Guard troops fired on students at Kent State. Four were killed, nine others wounded. In 1970, Philip Caputo was a young reporter for the Chicago Tribune. He was one of the first reporters on the scene, and he's the author of a new book titled 13 Seconds, A Look Back at the Kent State Shootings. He will be the guest today on the Afternoon Magazine. He'll be talking with Celeste Quinn in the 1 o'clock hour of the show, and that program gets underway at noon here on AM 580. The next hour of this program, we'll be talking some about the images that the West and Westerners have long had about Asia, East Asia. And our guest with the program, journalist Sheridan Prosso, she works for Business Week magazine, has written a lot about Asia. She has a new